This is the Behave Yourself podcast, a podcast about behavioral science in the Global South, brought to you by the Busara Center for Behavioral Economics. I'm your host, Linda Kimaru. In today's episode, Amy, our qualitative researcher, is back.
We're talking about social norm change in the Global South, applying lessons learned from CMU.
And this time, she's brought along a special guest.
Again, my name is Sion Bernard. I'm a behavioral economist and a professor at Swarthmore College in the U.S. right outside
Sion
Philadelphia.
Sion is a friend of Busara and is interested in pro-social behavior, development, and personal finance solutions. His work primarily involves running randomized field experiments. And in addition to his position at Swarthmore, he is also a founding member of the Philadelphia Behavioral Science Initiative, a senior researcher at the Applied Cooperation Team, a research affiliate at Busara Center, and vice president of BEMA, that is the Behavioral and Experimental Economists of the Mid-Atlantic. Welcome to the second episode of Behave Yourself, a conversation about social norm change.
How did you hear about this field?
It's a great question. I was in graduate school, like many others, not sure exactly what I wanted to do, which is, I think sometimes people think they're supposed to figure out what they want to do before they go to graduate school, but that is not true for the vast majority of people in graduate school. They're just trying to figure out what they want to do while they're there. I was lucky enough to be at the Kennedy School at Harvard, which was, full of people who applied different empirical approaches, different conceptual approaches to solving problems. And somewhere along the way, I kind of came across behavioral economics, behavioral science, and found that motivating, exciting. I always loved economics, but there was a little piece of me which kind of felt like, this isn't quite how people make choices, but I appreciate the role of modeling, and I appreciate the role of having these assumptions that enable that modeling. But slowly got exposed to some of the more recent behavioral economics work, which went beyond the lab and into more real-world settings, behavior in real-world contexts, including sports and finance and business. And I kind of thought there's actually a lot going on here. And at that time, there wasn't a lot happening in the policy domain. In that regard, it was just kind of getting started. So that was Busara, that was the Behavioral Insights team, Ideas 42, that was really like in its early stage. All those organizations were really in their very early stages. So I was just lucky enough to be there at the right place, the right time. At the same time, I also sort of found field experiments through some interactions with John List from Chicago, came to speak at Harvard a couple times, and I went out and visited him in Chicago, and I really got enamored of the field experimental technique. I always felt like I was a really applied researcher. I guess that confluence of factors of course brought me to Busara's door as somebody who worked in development, worked in Kenya for a year after graduating college with the International Rescue Committee. So I've always sort of had a connection to the development economic space, done some work with the World Bank prior to graduate school. So, my eyes were always towards the developing world, and being lucky enough to meet Channing and James and Johannes and all the other folks at Busara early on in grad school, I think was a key part of that. So long answer to a short question, but a lot of different pieces of it.
Well, we're lucky to have you. Thank you so much. A lot of what you're saying resonates about this applied research and how we can take lessons that we know about the intention to action gap and see how this is actually manifesting in our day-to-day lives. So today we're going to be talking about these intentions and actions in relation to social norms. So when we think about social norms, we often dictate our actions based on what we think other people expect us to do. With the coronavirus, can you talk about the belief gap or our potential false beliefs we may hold about others' attitudes?
Yeah, it's an important question. I think that a critical aspect of making the right choice or the collectively beneficial choice is for there to be some alignment between what you think about other people, both what other people are doing, but also what other people are thinking about what you should be doing. And that should actually be aligned with what people actually feel, right? So if, for example, you're at a school where, I'm here at Swarthmore, so this is true here at Swarthmore, students see other students studying a lot. They also think that other students expect them to study a lot. And so you can imagine that just ratchets up the pressure on themselves to study a lot, right? So there's no gap really there in my expectations of what others expect of me, and you know, what others truly expect of me. Bring that to COVID-19 and social distancing and now mask wearing and other behaviors that are going to come down the road. The concern might be that people think that other people feel a certain way, but in fact, they feel very different. So I'll give you an example from a survey we've done here in Pennsylvania. Myself, Dan Hopkins, and Allison Buttenheim, the two of them are at Penn. We ran some surveys trying to understand how people felt about social distancing and mask wearing themselves, and then what they thought other people felt. So essentially, you know, think about yourself, what's important to you, and most people said social distancing is very important. I appreciate it when other people social distance. I appreciate it when other people wear masks when social distancing is not possible. And then when we asked them the same, not that question, how do you feel, but how do you think others feel? They were much more, I guess, pessimistic about other people's beliefs. They said, oh, other people don't care about these things, but I really care about it, and I wish other people did too. Right? But of course, we were asking other people, and other people were also saying, no, I actually do care about this. So there seems to be this gap, basically. People believe that everyone else is almost judging them for crossing the street and keeping distance or wearing a mask, or, you know, people look at you funny and you think, oh, you know, people are judging me, and they think I'm overreacting. But actually what they're thinking empirically, we seem to find, is they're, if anything, thankful that you're doing that. Even if they're not doing it, they kind of feel like, I wish other people were doing it. So I think the more we can get that message across to people, so we've been working here at the City of Philadelphia to basically try to convey that message, right? That like people looking at you wearing the mask are not judging you. They're actually just like, oh, what a great person, right? And so the more we can kind of convey that true belief, I think that really help lock in these social norms.
Have you done any previous work around messaging where you've tried to correct false beliefs? By saying like a certain number of people in your community think this, get on board.
Yeah, I mean, it's always tricky to measure beliefs. I mean, so I haven't done as much work on this because I guess I'm not one of the many researchers who study beliefs and belief formation in great depth. I've often just worked on thinking about conveying what we call descriptive social norms, the idea of like, here's what other people are doing, and conveying that to people and hoping that that's motivating. Or social judgments. So the idea of saying, you know, other people are doing this, and if you're not doing it, they think you're a bad person, right? Kind of that sort of view. So you can think about that as correcting people's beliefs about the judgments of others. So in that regard, I have done some work. And what we tend to find is that when you really convey in a very clear way the social judgment that others hold when they see and when they observe a certain behavior, it can be a really powerful part of a sort of social norms messaging campaign, right? So it's not enough to say, you know, 28% of people are doing X or 83% of people are doing X, but you also have to convey the idea that like, and they think that you should be doing it too, or, and they think that if you're not doing it, it's a bad thing, right? Or you're in the minority of people who are doing this bad behavior, right? So you really need to convey that social judgment as well.
So you're almost evoking shame, if I'm hearing you. Wow.
Yeah, almost. I mean, you know, what we really want to think about is, you know, I don't want to, in a sense, I don't want to shame
you.
Well, I don't want to shame you into doing something if it's going to lead to a short-term behavior change, right? It's kind of like, well, I feel bad for, 5 minutes, and maybe I'll take a shorter shower next time, but then I'll quickly rehabituate back to my old behavior, right? The big, like, nut to crack, which many researchers are trying at the moment, and we're all trying to gather better information on this, is long-run behavior change, right? I mean, we want to find something that actually locks in a long-run change. And for me, social norms has greater potential than just shaming, right? So I think there's also limits to, at least in the context of COVID-19, if we think about shaming, which is happening, right? People going on Twitter and look at this jerk in my neighborhood biking around with no mask on or whatever. I think a lot of that is really self-focus. It's really like you as an individual saying, I want to send a signal to my community, which is that I don't approve of this. But if you think about who's receiving that message, it's not a lot of bikers in your community. It's your friend network who are statistically likely to agree with you as it stands. So you're really just, it's not quite virtue signaling, but it's close to that. You're just sort of saying, you know, here's this behavior that I don't approve of. And your friends say, yeah, good for you. You know, like,
you're in an echo chamber.
I also don't approve. Yeah, and you're back in that echo chamber. So for me, I think the really important thing is trying to find a good way to confront people in your neighborhood or send a signal to people in your neighborhood of what is appreciated and not appreciated behavior. Mm-hmm. And it could be, like I know I saw some signs up in our neighborhood around like, you know, if you're biking or running, please wear a mask. Like or I think it was something like, if you're biking or running, you're wearing a mask, we love you, that kind of thing, right? Which is basically like, we really appreciate you so bikers and runners can go by. And it kind of shames the people who aren't wearing one. I think it was like written by a kid, so it was like in crayon, you know. Mm. So it's really charming. It's like, oh, you know, so sweet. And if you don't have the mask on, you're thinking, oh, you know, this feels bad. This kid is probably not approving of what I'm doing, sweet little five-year-old who wrote this sign. And if you are wearing one, it gives you that little bit of a boost, you know, like, oh, somebody approves of my behavior, right? So I think that kind of tool is, I wouldn't say it's shaming people. It's almost more taking the approved behavior and putting a little star next to it. Mm. And I think that can be maybe a little bit more uplifting.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it. I listened to you talk about how you wrote a letter to a neighbor and you encouraged them to do their part. And I tried this in person, actually. And it,
oh, cool.
It worked. It worked. But I felt doing, I was nervous. I don't know if you felt nervous. And I'm curious, like, why... when we're trying to encourage behavior, we may feel in the wrong doing so.
Yeah, I mean, there's, yeah, I was gonna say, there's sort of a natural feeling that, like, you know, I don't wanna be like nagging somebody else, right? Or, you know, I don't wanna be approaching someone and saying, you know what, like, I disapprove of this behavior and here I am standing in front of you because there's a reputational cost, right? I mean, let's go outside of COVID. I mean, you can think of, you know, another persistent social problem, but maybe longer running than COVID, is something like sexual assault or abuse on campuses, right? So if you think about a big issue there, there's a lot of college parties where someone is acting inappropriately or kind of getting towards the line of inappropriate behavior, and their friends don't say anything, right? And so this has been observed, this idea of the bystander, the sort of silent bystander. And, you know, you can think in that domain, you know, this person probably doesn't approve and it feels some reason why that, you know, there's some reason kind of preventing them from saying something to their friend, right? And I think that's clearly another source social pressure, right? Like if you're that guy or that lady who says, you know what, like maybe you've had enough tonight or kind of shepherds your friend away from this person that they're bothering, you know, you could imagine that being uncomfortable for you, right? There's like a social reputational cost that you bear. And to do that, so it's easier to just kind of quietly say nothing, right? So I feel like that's a similar scenario with COVID. There's people doing things that you might feel like, you know, it's my neighbor. I got to live with my neighbor after COVID-19 is hopefully long gone. I don't want them to hate me forever. You know, what are the odds that you know, they lead to me being infected with COVID? Maybe it's a low probability. I'll just kind of suffer in silence and I won't say anything. So my worry is that a lot of people are in that camp, or they're in the camp of, you know, I do want to say something, but I want to say it to an approving audience. So I'll go to my Twitter page or I'll go to Instagram and I'll, you know, say this to people I know will be like, yeah, you know, that's horrible. But I'd never actually communicate to the person who's doing the thing to say, hey, listen, you know, I see where you're coming from. This idea of empathizing with them to some extent, right? I know it's hard. You know, we're all in this together. Trying to find that right messaging is actually pretty challenging. I mean, even when I did it with my neighbor, I did it anonymously, right? I wrote them an anonymous note because I didn't want to sign it and be like, oh, that jerk who lives in that house over there is going around telling people what to do, but rather try to convey in a polite way and also a way that's like understanding of others and empathetic to others. That way, I don't want to trigger their defensiveness as soon as their two senses end. So I think we have to find a way to approach people that isn't like, hey, stop being a jerk, you know, like that. Nobody reacts well to that. Right. So finding a way to say like, let me just kind of lay the groundwork for common understanding and then just convey how I'm feeling and I totally empathize and, you know, like, let's try to do this all together. And maybe there's some things that I could do better too. If you could, you know, like, let's try to find a way in our neighborhood to, you know, find a good equilibrium.
I wonder if you've seen any gender differences in people who are willing to bear that reputational cost.
I haven't seen that, actually. That's a good question. I'm sure there's work out there on this with a number of researchers in this space, but there's certainly some evidence around women being more willing to undertake pro-social behaviors in general. There's this prominent paper around you know, women being more likely to be asked to and more likely to say yes to non-promotable tasks in the workplace. Right. It's obviously a slightly different domain, but you can imagine that the same logic might apply here, that this might be the kind of behavior that women may be more prone to take on. They have to suffer a cost, a reputational cost, and there's a collective benefit. If you know, those insights translate, you might expect that women are maybe more likely to speak up and say something. I guess you could say that you sort of see that in this new term, the Karen. You know, you've probably heard about this now. Term is really taking off. This idea of like the lady in your neighborhood who's kind of badgering people to behave the right way. Obviously, there's some sexism baked into the term itself, but you know, the fact that it's a Karen and not a Carl, I think, is indicative of the fact that I think women are more or seem to be more prone to say, you know what, I actually don't approve of this behavior, and maybe that's socialized, right? That women play that role in our contemporary society more so than men, who are occupying a different social role, and maybe detrimentally so, right? You know, that's just my inclination. I don't have empirical results to back that up, but we do have the anecdote of the Karen term.
The Karen.
And it's a bit unfortunate, but I do think that this might be one of those circumstances where we might view it as maybe men aren't doing this enough versus women are doing it too much kind of thing. We need men to step up. You know, obviously in the sexual assault example, a lot of these bystanders are actually men who know the other men who are committing these acts. So we actually have to find a way to sort of make it appropriate for men to feel socially that they can speak up, right? Right now, the social norm maybe is for men to behave in a different way, which may be detrimental in a lot of different domains.
And also maybe not have a gendered response to that reputational cost, like not differentially praise men for speaking up while telling women maybe to take a back seat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about the distinction between social norms and moral norms.
It's time for your behavioral science term of the week. You had Amy and Sion talk about why people don't speak out during sexual assault cases on campuses in the U.S. and how this is similar to why we don't call out others on their behavior during the COVID-19 pandemic. What they're describing is known as the bystander effect. The bystander effect is a social psychological theory that simply states the more people present during a phenomenon, the less likely people are to intervene in an emergency situation. Now, back to the episode.
Okay, welcome back to Behave Yourself. I'm here with Sion Banot, and we are discussing social norm change in the context of COVID-19. So where we left off, we were talking about gender differences and social norms, and now we're going to transition into the fine, blurry line between social and moral norms. So last time we spoke, Sion was telling me about his colleague and friend, Christina Vicieri, who is a leading scholar in this domain. And she was discussing how oftentimes in order to change a social norm, we have to alter beliefs, preferences, and social expectations. But these are often conditional on normative and empirical social expectations, whereas for a moral norm, these are based on unconditional preferences. I'm curious if you've seen this show up in your work.
Yeah, so, you know, certainly here and there, and we've seen it in COVID as well. I mean, just to make super clear the distinction, I mean, you can almost think of a social norm as something I do because I sort of expect others to do it, and I expect that others think I should do it. But the moral norm is almost something where you feel like it doesn't matter if everyone else isn't doing it. I think it's the morally right thing to do, right? So if you imagine, you know, a bunch of your neighbors started attacking each other, a lot of us would say, you know, I'm not going to just join in, right? Even though everyone in my town seems to be going nuts and attacking each other, maybe morally, I feel like the fact that everyone else is doing it doesn't draw me into the behavior. I actually would do it unconditional. It's not conditional on what other people are doing. If that makes
it's a value-based.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, somebody could knock on your door and say, hey, everyone's doing it in the town. Unfortunately, it seems like for a lot of folks, environmental conservation behaviors are sometimes in that social norm space where you're not going to do it unless other people are doing it. So the big challenge is how do we convince people that certain behaviors are, in fact, morally right to do, regardless of what everyone else is doing, especially in a domain where people aren't necessarily doing the right thing. Here's like, for example, energy conservation. That's where I do a lot of my work. Where for a lot of people, they think I'm going to conserve energy regardless of what everyone else is doing. In my town, they might be all using tons of electricity, but I'm not going to do it because it's the morally right thing to do is to, you know, reduce my emissions, right?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot in relation to the Black Lives Matter movement and the recent uptake in white allyship. And I think for a lot of people, well, I don't want to speak for a lot of people, but this is something that has, you know, been on people's radars, but this is the first time a lot of people are actively speaking out and speaking out for this long. So can you talk a little bit about how behavioral economics principles might explain some of that herd behavior?
Yeah, so I think you described it well as sort of herd behavior. You always have to tread carefully when talking about some of these issues. I don't want to make it sound like people who are speaking out now are somehow lemmings following the herd who don't actually care about these issues. It's almost more that the social context has given them permission to think more deeply about this and stand up for a certain position, right? Same thing with, like, in the aftermath of gun violence, a lot of people stand up and speak to gun issues, you know, folks who might be sort of pro-gun control anyway, but it's just not a salient thing. You can kind of think about it as a salience issue, right? When something saliently bubbles to the surface in society, people feel like they want to rally around the flag of that topic. And then as soon as it drifts away, the next thing pops up and people rally around that, right? So I'm not saying that change doesn't happen, but I think for people trying to make change, right, in the immediate aftermath, you have to find a way to, you know, as I think you flagged in the past, you've described it as, to maintain that momentum, right? Like, how do we keep that allyship from being not like a virtue signaling, right, during this hot moment, and think about kind of turning that into sustaining behavior change. And that's really the challenge for activists, for social justice advocates. How do we actually do that? Otherwise, you know, if the protest you went to is the last thing that you do, it's not going to create lasting change, right? So if everybody who's on the streets is the last thing they're going to do for addressing systematic racism, like, nothing's going to happen. And sadly, that is the history, right, of some of these topics, right? It's a very slow arc towards justice, and I think it's a slow bending arc because a lot of this becomes not salient after a while. A different problem crops up and people kind of gravitate their energy towards that. It's hard to get people to collectively mobilize behind an issue, and it's the secret sauce is like figuring out how to harness that.
But I really appreciated what you saying about how this context has given people a new permission to speak up and a new way to do so.
And it's also just making salient the things that you could do in your own life, right? And I think everybody can look at what's been going on and say, well, there's at least, hopefully, most people have changed at least one thing, right? Or at least thought for a few minutes about something in their life that they basically didn't have the bandwidth to think about before. You can almost think about it through the lens of scarcity. So this terrific work by Sendel Mullnathan and Eldar Shafia, this great book called Scarcity.
The book Theon mentions is called Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, and it's written by Sendil Mullnathan and Eldar Shafir. We will link it in the show notes.
Where they talk about how when you've got like a million things going on, your plate is full, you know, your Google Calendar is full, you really don't have like any wiggle room or any what they call slack in your schedule or bandwidth, you know, we have used that term bandwidth too now, to engage with like what you truly believe and what truly motivates you. You're just plowing through your emails every day or whatever. So you don't really ever think about like what social justice issues really rile me up, right? But now with COVID, it's almost like everybody's got way more slack and some people have way more than they would like. So lots of free time to fill. And so, you know, some people are filling it with, you know, fake news and trolling around on Twitter or whatever. So that's not really necessarily good. But I think a lot of people are filling it with, you know, what's going on in the world? And, you know, what are some of these systemic injustices? What are these protests about? Maybe I should learn a little bit about that. Maybe I should be reading a little bit more about that or reading a few articles about it. And I think that obviously combined with the permission that you're given to explore these issues through the salience of this topic, I think is leading more people to speak out, not because they are necessarily jumping on board, but more like, oh, wow, I have some time to actually think about these issues and decide what I feel about important social topics.
Yeah, like to critically engage and slow down and think through their role in it. Very interesting. We've talked a bit about social movements and how we can carry it and sustain momentum in the long term. I know you've worked on some other interventions that have also tried to motivate long-term behavior change, specifically with encouraging people to continue adhering to TB medication. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that, how you used feature phones and adherence contests to kind of motivate this adaptive behavior.
Yeah, so this is a specific project, and thank you for bringing it up. It's one of my favorites, which is looking at tuberculosis medication adherence in Kenya. This study, we're now expanding to some other countries as well. But what we did was we worked with a digital health company called Kahila, and we built this sort of phone-based platform for folks who have TB. So I don't know how much you know about TB, but it's a respiratory illness. It's infectious, so that you know you can infect your neighbors, you can infect your family if you have it, and there's a treatment for it. It's curable through the treatment. In a lot of developing countries like Kenya, the treatment is free or made free through foreign aid support and through government support. So here we have a serious disease that can spread in communities. That's curable. Now, what's the hang-up, right? What's the issue? Why can't we just cure it with everybody taking the meds and it's the end of TB? Well, a lot of people who take the meds or receive the meds to take don't complete treatment properly, and basically TB doesn't go away from their system, right, in the allocated time. So a big issue is adherence to the medication. If you think about last time you took antibiotics, most of us have at some point had to take antibiotics. Usually the doctor gives you a 2-week course or a 3-week course or whatever it is, and they make a point as you're leaving the office, finish the whole course, right? And a lot of us have done that, and a lot of us have not done that, right? You know, you feel okay after 4 or 5 days, you don't like the side effects, you're like, eh, it's fine. Like, I'm cured. They gave me 10 pills, but like, I'm gonna take 4. And as soon as I'm fine, it's over. I'm just gonna move on, right? With TB, it's even more challenging because these courses can be not 2 or 3 weeks, it can be 6 or 9 months. So you really have to think long-term behavior change, right? It's hard enough getting people to take the pills for 2 weeks. How do we get them to sustain taking them for 6 to 9 months? So our approach was a bit of throwing the kitchen sink at it to some extent, right? And building a tool that tried to incorporate many different features. And we'd love to triangulate exactly which one was driving the behavior change the most, but we incorporated a number of things in there. So one was messaging that focused on the collective benefits of you taking the medication. I think people can feel alone and isolated when they have a disease, whether it's TB or COVID or whatever, that like, this is like my, for lack of a better term, my battle alone, right? Like it's me and I have to get cured, and they feel like it's their fault for getting it, or there's a stigma that I have this. We wanted them to feel part of a community working to eradicate this disease. So kind of like messaging around, you know, you're doing your part to eradicate the disease. So that was transmitted over the text messaging platform. They also got to check in every day, make sure they took their meds. And if they didn't respond every day, they would get somebody else communicating with them. It wasn't us, it was what we called a support sponsor. So someone else who was hired by us as a trained intermediary is not quite the right term, but a trained individual from the community. So someone in the case of Kenya was a Kenyan person, but not only that, a Kenyan person who themselves had recovered from TB or had a family member who had been affected by TB. And so they could then reach out directly to the person in whatever way they felt comfortable. We didn't really monitor or tell them what to say. You know, they would reach out and say, hey, listen, you know, you haven't responded. What's going on? You know, I had TB. You really have to take the meds every day. Like, you can't skip or you will not get cured. You know, so trying to communicate to them in a more human-to-human way. And then, of course, like you mentioned, we had these adherence contests. We had, like, a leaderboard to bring that sort of social pressure of, like, oh, I want to get myself to the top of the leaderboard by doing it every day. We had the equivalent of, like, a Livestrong, like, one of those bracelets that people could wear as, like, an observable, like, I'm part of the movement here, right? So getting back to the social movement idea, I think it's much, people feel a lot more empowered when they feel like I'm just one of many who are part of this movement to do this great thing for society. It's just a lot more of encouraging a message than you have this disease and like you have to go home and take these meds. And you know, that can be a little bit isolating. It can be frustrating. As soon as you start feeling better, you think, I feel fine. So I can end this, you know, kind of lonely experience now of being ill. But actually we need you to complete the medication. Otherwise we deal with multi-drug resistant TB and things like that. So that was our kind of approach, was basically like hitting them over the head every day, you know, making salient to people what they had to do, but also giving them this kind of framework around it, which was behaviorally informed, like you're part of this movement. And, you know, there's positive messaging too. It's not just all kind of in the dour negative domain. And, you know, big picture, we ran an RCT in Kenya with about 1,100 people, 550 treatment, 550 control, something like that. And failure rates dropped from something like 13% who failed to be cured down to about 4%. So huge effect size. That was just published last year. So we're really excited about that. We think that this could be scaled up for all kinds of diseases. Right? There's no reason why it should just be TB. You know, and I will add critically that our study, unlike some other studies, this is maybe a little bit inside baseball, but when you're thinking about studies or behavior change, it's really important to think about the outcome that you're actually measuring. Because a lot of folks that I've interacted with, they think, oh, I want to change X, but their outcome is very fuzzy. You know, I want to increase engagement. You know, it's something very vague, you know, or I want to increase capacity to do this. I mean, what does that even mean? So in a lot of cases with studies on behavior change in the long run, the outcome variable is something that's not actually what you're trying to do. So in the case of medication adherence, like taking your medication seems like a reasonable outcome. But that's not really the outcome. That's a step in the process. The actual outcome is, am I cured of TB?
Right. And
so our outcome variable of interest was, are you cured of TB? I almost don't care if you say you took your meds, because, I mean, honestly, I don't really care that you claim that you took them, because what really will be the proof in the pudding is, are you cured of TB? Because if you say you took them, but you're not cured, I'm very skeptical that you actually took them, right? Mm-hmm. Statistically speaking, it's very unlikely that you could take all your pills and not get cured. I mean, this is a curable disease. So we try to focus on that outcome, and a lot of prior studies hadn't. And they focused on whether you said that you took your medication, which to me is interesting, but I don't think it's as important as whether or not you're actually cured, which was our focus.
Two things struck me when you were talking about Fahila. One is this emphasis on what are you measuring? Is it your process versus your outcome variable? And make sure you're really honing in on what do you want your outcome to be. And the second thing that I hear you say when you're talking about Kahila is that you're designing for your end user and you're keeping them at the helm. When you were discussing like their support buddy, it can really tell it was designed with empathy in mind, which I think is why it led to such success. I mean, you're still trying to figure out which component of the multifaceted intervention contributed to it, but I think that's really special. So.
Yeah, I mean, oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I'll have one other feature, because I want to make sure they get enough credit. The support sponsors were also, and the local community in Kenya were also critical for message formation. So as it turns out, you know, there's a lot of well-to-do and, you know, well-minded researchers or people coming with the right spirit, like us Western researchers who really want to help folks in other contexts improve their lives. But fundamentally, we don't know exactly what the right way is to motivate other populations with different cultures, different underlying motivators. So the support sponsors and the other Kenyan staff were critical in basically editing our draft text messages, right? The ones that went out with, you know, when you say, I did take my meds, you got kind of like a thank you for doing your part kind of message. The actual wording of those messages was edited, and in some cases heavily edited by the Kenyan staff that we worked with, because they basically said, oh, this is a very nice idea, but like, wow, you guys are really horrible at writing text messages to Kenyans. Why don't we rephrase that in a way that, you know, will work better, combinations of Swahili, but, you know, all kinds of different ways to like send the message and make it feel like a human message rather than like a robot sending you a message, or even worse, a Western researcher sending you.
Way worse.
Yeah, much worse. So, you know, I think part of the empathy just comes through that, is just, you know, making sure that you empower the people who are better able to shape behavior change than you are. And I think that's been something I've tried to do in my research. Maybe you could even do a better job, is making sure to work with local, not just stakeholders, but just normal people in the communities that you're working in, and trying to understand that, you know, you probably don't fully appreciate what motivates them the most. And so relying on other folks in those communities, I think, a really useful tool.
Absolutely. I hear you. Like, acknowledging and honoring that people are the experts of their own lives. I think that this is a great place to take a break. When we come back, we'll have our final conversation about how we can reconcile knowledge gaps with structural constraints. Welcome back. I'm here with my guest, Sion Banos. So now we're going to talk about some challenges that we face when working in the Global South. And oftentimes, there might be this underlying assumption that people might know or have misinformation around a certain topic, when really it's not necessarily a knowledge gap, but rather a structural constraint. So I think that we've seen this in some preliminary COVID research that Busara has done, where people know that they should be hand washing or should be wearing a mask and social distancing, but there's challenges with actualizing that. Like, you know, people share latrines or share hand washing stations and or live in really high dense areas, so it's a lot harder to social distance. So I'm curious, if you've seen that with your own research and things that you've maybe done to leverage some of that going forward.
So there's a lot of different things that I think we have to keep in mind, especially with COVID and research in the Global South, or how should, quote unquote, how should the Global South respond to COVID? It's not as easy as, you know, look at what the Western countries are doing and do that. Because just the whole, I mean, you know, population density, let alone, you know, cultural differences. I mean, there's so many different aspects that vary in you know, India versus America, right? So I know that in the early days, some people were worried that maybe India was too much adopting the approach of Western countries when it has a very different set of circumstances, in the same way that, you know, LA and Philadelphia should not have the same reaction because they have very different geographical, physical cultures, really about where people are spatially relative to one another and their day-to-day lives, right?
So, and different histories of how diseases have been managed in the past.
Yeah, exactly. So there's so many, I mean, even within country, I mean, let alone across countries, there's so many, there has to be so many different strategies for approaching this. If you really just think about it, as fundamentally, there's like physical beings who are interacting in a variety of different ways. And, you know, how do we encourage them to do it in the safest way? And there's also these, I wouldn't even really call it structural, but like, people die in the Global South from more things, right, than people do in developed countries, right? A larger array of possible reasons to cause serious illness because of financial constraints, right? So, you know, people are dying of things in Nairobi that you would never die of in a suburb in America just because of resources, right? You know, I think a lot of us, this is what drives us to want to do research in the Global South. You know, we just don't find that fair. I mean, something's fundamentally wrong with that, that like, you know, something I can get for $20 could save somebody's life somewhere halfway around the world. And so in the case of COVID, for example, I do think we have to be mindful of the fact that, well, there's a whole different sort of public health environment, right, in a country like Kenya. And that might mean that they should optimally react to COVID in a different way. I'm not saying that they shouldn't shut down and shouldn't do X, Y, and Z, because we understand how epidemic disease spreads. But I do think that there has to be maybe more of a recognition of some of the disparities that exist already. In the same way that I think people are looking at different parts of the U.S. and thinking, well, you know, in certain communities in the U.S., the fact that the COVID death rate is higher is because they've been underserved in other domains, right? Immune systems are weakened by poor water infrastructure, you know, poor medical infrastructure in certain communities. Basically years of neglect, right? Obviously with the Black Lives Matter movement and this focus on Black Americans being more susceptible to COVID, it's not just because the disease is designed to be, more damaging to Black communities, but because Black communities have been marginalized from various aspects of society. There's a reason why they have you know, found themselves in a position that they're more vulnerable to the disease. And I think people are starting to face up to these systematic problems too, right? So I think those same things will be true in Kenya, right? Where similarly, there's communities of every background who are marginalized. And I think it's just about trying to navigate that the best that you can and trying to come up with like optimal strategy, right? What's the optimal approach? And I don't always think it's the Western one. I think we have to be more sensitive to like local constraints and then local structural problems.
Great. And I also think something that you were talking about last time is like within these systems, there's structural strengths to like heightened visibility for community leaders to really shine. So I thought that was an interesting point that you've made in the past.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about like, you know, Western society is, my parents are Indian immigrants to the US, you know, and one thing that they bemoan about Western society is the sort of individualism of it, right? It's kind of like you live in your house with your driveway and you park your car or whatever. And even, you know, if you look at a middle-class American, you know, a lot of middle-class Americans have their own driveway and their own house and their own little fence or whatever, and they are kind of their own little pod, and then they go from this pod to their work pod, and they come back to their home pod, and it's very much that's the society. But in American cities, and also more frequently in the Global South, certainly in India, it's a lot more of like a community-focused living structure. Maybe families living with multi-generational housing, right? That's starting to become more common in the U.S. too, but there it's much more frequent that, you know, people are living with their parents and their kids, you know. So I think in that world where there's this more community focus, there's, you know, more potential for influence community member to community member, you have a great strength in the spreading of social norms, right? It's a lot harder to spread social norms, one could argue, and I think probably this is true in a more individualistic society where people are really looking out for me and, you know, I'm looking out for me and my own, that kind of thing. Versus in some of these other societies where you can imagine people are looking to others more for cues about what to do because they're just surrounded by other people more. So they're more used to this kind of collective, I guess you could say like signaling or cueing one another. So you can imagine if you can find those change agents in the communities who can spread the good social norms, that might be more effective than finding a similar one. In the US, it's just harder to find because everyone sort of feels like they're their own decision maker. Again, some of this is generalizing and I recognize that, but I think there's some truth to it. And there's obviously variation within the US and some of these metrics as well. But I do think that's a potential strength, right? That some of these communities might be able to self-organize at a lower level, at a local level, and you know, create the circumstances that protect everyone. Whereas that's proving clearly the US is not doing as well as we had hoped in response to this crisis. And I think part of that is, you know, our culture, our individual focused culture makes it a little bit, gives us one more barrier to overcome in getting people to, you know, wear masks, for example. People are more worried about how they look wearing the mask than about the fact that, well, it just helps everyone around you a little bit. And it's really not that much of a burden to bear. Whereas I feel like that kind of messaging in some other communities, we obviously have to test these things, but I have a hunch that it would work more effectively. Say, you know, you're doing this for the people around you who are always around you. I mean, it's just much more salient to you that other people can benefit from your action.
I agree. All right. Well, I think we'll end here. Thank you so much, Zion. Really appreciate having you here. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
And that's it for this week's episode of Behave Yourself. Join us next week for part 3 of this 4-part series on COVID-19. Many thanks to our special guest, Zion Banot, and you can find him on Twitter at SPBanot. Behave Yourself is a podcast produced by the Busara Center for Behavioral Economics. Find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Busara Center. And you can read our Busara Center blog about the work that we do on Medium. Until next time, behave yourself.